This is Audible.
Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban by J.K. Rowling. Read by Jim Dale. An unabridged performance brought to you by Pottermore from J.K. Rowling.
Chapter 1, Owl Post. Harry Potter was a highly unusual boy in many ways. For one thing, he hated the summer holidays more than any other time of year. For another, he really wanted to do his homework, but was forced to do it in secret, in the dead of night, and he also happened to be a wizard. It was nearly midnight, and he was lying on his stomach in bed, the blankets drawn right over his head like a tent, a flashlight in one hand, and a large leather-bound book, A History of Magic by Bathilda Bagshot, propped open against the pillow. Harry moved the tip of his eagle feather quill down the page, frowning as he looked for something that would help him write his essay, which burning in the 14th century was completely pointless. Discuss. The quill paused at the top of a likely-looking paragraph. Harry pushed his round glasses up the bridge of his nose, moved his flashlight closer to the book, and read. Non-magic people, more commonly known as muggles, were particularly afraid of magic in medieval times, but not very good at recognizing it. On the rare occasion that they did catch a real witch or wizard, burning had no effect whatsoever. The witch or wizard would perform a basic flame-freezing charm, and then pretend to shriek with pain while enjoying a gentle, tickling sensation. Indeed, Wendolyn the Weird enjoyed being burned so much that she allowed herself to be caught no less than 47 times in various disguises. Harry put his quill between his teeth and reached underneath his pillow for his ink bottle and a roll of parchment. Slowly and very carefully he unscrewed the ink bottle, dipped his quill into it, and began to write, pausing every now and then to listen, because if any of the Dursleys heard the scratching of his quill on their way to the bathroom, he'd probably find himself locked in the cupboard under the stairs for the rest of the summer. The Dursley family of Number 4 Privet Drive was the reason that Harry never enjoyed his summer holidays. Uncle Vernon, Aunt Petunia, and their son Dudley were Harry's only living relatives. They were muggles, and they had a very medieval attitude toward magic. Harry's dead parents, who had been a witch and wizard themselves, were never mentioned under the Dursleys' roof. For years Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon had hoped that if they kept Harry as downtrodden as possible, they would be able to squash the magic out of him. To their fury, they had been unsuccessful. These days, they lived in terror of anyone finding out that Harry had spent most of the last 2 years at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. The most they could do, however, was to lock away Harry's spell books, wand, cauldron, and broomstick, at the start of the summer break, and forbid him to talk to the neighbours. This separation from his spell books had been a real problem for Harry, because his teachers at Hogwarts had given him a lot of holiday work. One of the essays, a particularly nasty one about shrinking potions, was for Harry's least favourite teacher, Professor Snape, who would be delighted to have an excuse to give Harry detention for a month. Harry had therefore seized his chance in the first week of the holidays. While Uncle Vernon, Aunt Petunia, and Dudley had gone out into the front garden to admire Uncle Vernon's new company car, in very loud voices so that the rest of the street would notice it too, Harry had crept downstairs, picked the lock on the cupboard under the stairs, grabbed some of his books, and hidden them in his bedroom. As long as he didn't leave spots of ink on the sheets, the Dursleys need never know that he was studying magic by night. Harry was particularly keen to avoid trouble with his aunt and uncle at the moment, as they were already in an especially bad mood with him, all because he'd received a telephone call from a fellow wizard 1 week into the school vacation. Ron Weasley, who was one of Harry's best friends at Hogwarts, came from a whole family of wizards. This meant that he knew a lot of things Harry didn't, but had never used a telephone before. Most unluckily, it had been Uncle Vernon who had answered the call.
"Vernon Dursley speaking?"
Harry, who happened to be in the room at the time, froze as he heard Ron's voice answer.
"Hello, hello, can you hear me? I want to talk to Harry Potter."
Ron was yelling so loudly that Uncle Vernon jumped and held the receiver a foot away from his ear, staring at it with an expression of mingled fury and alarm.
"Who is this?"
he roared in the direction of the mouthpiece. "Who are you?"
"Ron Weasley,"
Ron bellowed back, as though he and Uncle Vernon were speaking from opposite ends of a football field.
"I'm a friend of Harry's from school."
Uncle Vernon's small eyes swiveled around to Harry, who was rooted to the spot.
"There is no Harry Potter here,"
he roared, now holding the receiver at arm's length, as though frightened it might explode.
"I don't know what school you're talking about. Never contact me again. Don't you come near my family."
And he threw the receiver back onto the telephone, as if dropping a poisonous spider. The fight that had followed had been one of the worst ever.
"How dare you give this number to people like you,"
Uncle Vernon had roared, spraying Harry with spit. Ron obviously realized that he'd gotten Harry into trouble because he hadn't called again. Harry's other best friend from Hogwarts, Hermione Granger, hadn't been in touch either. Harry suspected that Ron had warned Hermione not to call, which was a pity because Hermione, the cleverest witch in Harry's year, had muggle parents, knew perfectly well how to use a telephone, and would probably have had enough sense not to say that she went to Hogwarts. So Harry had had no word from any of his wizarding friends for 5 long weeks, and this summer was turning out to be almost as bad as the last one. There was just one very small improvement. After swearing that he wouldn't use her to send letters to any of his friends, Harry had been allowed to let his owl, Hedwig, out at night. Uncle Vernon had given in because of the racket Hedwig made if she was locked in her cage all the time. Harry finished writing about Wendelin the Weird and paused to listen again. The silence in the dark house was broken only by the distant, grunting snores of his enormous cousin Dudley. "It must be very late," Harry thought. His eyes were itching with tiredness. Perhaps he'd finish this essay tomorrow night. He replaced the top of the ink bottle, pulled an old pillowcase from under his bed, put the flashlight, a history of magic, his essay, quill, and ink inside it, got out of bed, and hid the lot under a loose floorboard under his bed. Then he stood up, stretched, and checked the time on the luminous alarm clock on his bedside table. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. Harry's stomach gave a funny jolt. He had been 13 years old without realizing it for a whole hour. Yet another unusual thing about Harry was how little he looked forward to his birthdays. He had never received a birthday card in his life. The Dursleys had completely ignored his last 2 birthdays, and he had no reason to suppose they would remember this one. Harry walked across the dark room, past Hedwig's large empty cage, to the open window. He leaned on the sill, the cool night air pleasant on his face after a long time under the blankets. Hedwig had been absent for 2 nights now. Harry wasn't worried about her. She'd been gone this long before, but he hoped she'd be back soon. She was the only living creature in this house who didn't flinch at the sight of him. Harry, though still rather small and skinny for his age, had grown a few inches over the last year. His jet-black hair, however, was just as it always had been, stubbornly untidy whatever he did to it. The eyes behind his glasses were bright green, and on his forehead, clearly visible through his hair, was a thin scar, shaped like a bolt of lightning. Of all the unusual things about Harry, this scar was the most extraordinary of all. It was not, as the Dursleys had pretended for 10 years, a souvenir of the car crash that had killed Harry's parents, because Lily and James Potter had not died in a car crash. They had been murdered. Murdered by the most feared dark wizard for 100 years, Lord Voldemort. Harry had escaped from the same attack with nothing more than a scar on his forehead, where Voldemort's curse, instead of killing him, had rebounded upon its originator. Barely alive, Voldemort had fled. But Harry had come face to face with him at Hogwarts. Remembering their last meeting as he stood at the dark window, Harry had to admit he was lucky even to have reached his 13th birthday. He scanned the starry sky for a sign of Hedwig, perhaps soaring back to him with a dead mouse dangling from her beak, expecting praise. Gazing absently over the rooftops, it was a few seconds before Harry realized what he was seeing. Silhouetted against the golden moon, and growing larger every moment, was a large, strangely lopsided creature, and it was flapping in Harry's direction. He stood quite still, watching it sink lower and lower. For a split second he hesitated, his hand on the window latch, wondering whether to slam it shut. But then the bizarre creature soared over one of the street lamps of Privet Drive, and Harry, realizing what it was, leapt aside. Through the window soared three owls, two of them holding up the third, which appeared to be unconscious. They landed with a soft thlump on Harry's bed, and the middle owl, which was large and grey, keeled right over and lay motionless. There was a large package tied to its legs. Harry recognized the unconscious owl at once. His name was Errol, and he belonged to the Weasley family. Harry dashed to the bed, untied the cords around Errol's legs, took off the parcel, and then carried Errol to Hedwig's cage. Errol opened one bleary eye, gave a feeble hoot of thanks, and began to gulp some water. Harry turned back to the remaining owls. One of them, the large snowy female, was his own Hedwig. She too was carrying a parcel and looked extremely pleased with herself. She gave Harry an affectionate nip with her beak as he removed her burden, then flew across the room to join Errol. Harry didn't recognize the third owl, a handsome tawny one, but he knew at once where it had come from, because in addition to a third package, it was carrying a letter bearing the Hogwarts crest. When Harry relieved this owl of its burden, it ruffled its feathers importantly, stretched its wings, and took off through the window into the night. Harry sat down on his bed and grabbed Errol's package, ripped off the brown paper, and discovered a present wrapped in gold, and his first ever birthday card. Fingers trembling slightly, he opened the envelope. Two pieces of paper fell out, a letter and a newspaper clipping. The clipping had clearly come out of the wizarding newspaper, the Daily Prophet, because the people in the black and white picture were moving. Harry picked up the clipping, smoothed it out, and read, "Ministry of Magic employee scoops grand prize. Arthur Weasley, head of the Misuse of Muggle Artifacts Office at the Ministry of Magic, has won the annual Daily Prophet grand prize galleon draw. A delighted Mr. Weasley told the Daily Prophet, 'We will be spending the gold on a summer holiday in Egypt, where our eldest son Bill works as a curse breaker for Gringotts Wizarding Bank. The Weasley family will be spending a month in Egypt, returning for the start of the new school year at Hogwarts, which five of the Weasley children currently attend.'" Harry scanned the moving photograph, and a grin spread across his face as he saw all nine of the Weasleys waving furiously at him, standing in front of a large pyramid, plump little Mrs. Weasley, tall, balding Mr. Weasley, six sons and one daughter, all, though the black and white picture didn't show it, with flaming red hair. Right in the middle of the picture was Ron, tall and gangling, with his pet rat, Scabbers, on his shoulder and his arm around his little sister Ginny. Harry couldn't think of anyone who deserved to win a large pile of gold more than the Weasleys, who were very nice and extremely poor. He picked up Ron's letter and unfolded it. "Dear Harry, happy birthday. Look, I'm really sorry about that telephone call. I hope the Muggles didn't give you a hard time. I asked Dad and he reckons I shouldn't have shouted. It's amazing here in Egypt. Bill's taken us around all the tombs, and you wouldn't believe the curses those old Egyptian wizards put on them. Mum wouldn't let Ginny come in the last one. There were all these mutant skeletons in there, of Muggles who'd broken in and grown extra heads and stuff. I couldn't believe it when Dad won the Daily Prophet draw. 700 galleons, most of it gone on this trip, but they're going to buy me a new wand for next year." Harry remembered only too well the occasion when Ron's old wand had snapped. It had happened when the car the two of them had been flying to Hogwarts had crashed into a tree on the school grounds. "We'll be back about a week before term starts, and we'll be going up to London to get my wand and our new books. Any chance of meeting you there? Don't let the Muggles get you down. Try and come to London. Ron. P.S. Percy's head boy. He got the letter last week." Harry glanced back at the photograph. Percy, who was in his seventh and final year at Hogwarts, was looking particularly smug. He had pinned his head boy badge to the fez perched jauntily on top of his neat hair, his horn-rimmed glasses flashing in the Egyptian sun. Harry now turned to his present and unwrapped it. Inside was what looked like a miniature glass spinning top. There was another note from Ron beneath it. "Harry, this is a pocket sneakerscope. If there's someone untrustworthy around, it's supposed to light up and spin. Bill says it's rubbish, sold for wizard tourists, and isn't reliable, because it kept lighting up at dinner last night. But he didn't realize Fred and George had put beetles in his soup. Bye, Ron." Harry put the pocket sneakerscope on his bedside table, where it stood quite still, balanced on its point, reflecting the luminous hands of his clock. He looked at it happily for a few seconds, and then picked up the parcel Hedwig had brought. Inside this, too, there was a wrapped present, a card, and a letter, this time from Hermione. "Dear Harry, Ron wrote to me and told me about his phone call to your Uncle Vernon. I do hope you're all right. I'm on holiday in France at the moment, and I didn't know how I was going to send this to you. What if they'd opened it at customs? But then Hedwig turned up. I think she wanted to make sure you got something for your birthday for a change. I bought your present by owl order. There was an advertisement in the Daily Prophet. I've been getting it delivered. It's so good to keep up with what's going on in the wizarding world. Did you see that picture of Ron and his family a week ago? I bet he's learning loads. I'm really jealous. The ancient Egyptian wizards were fascinating. There's some interesting local history of witchcraft here, too. I've rewritten my whole history of magic essay to include some of the things I've found out. I hope it's not too long. It's two rolls of parchment more than Professor Binns asked for. Ron says he's going to be in London in the last week of the holidays. Can you make it? Will your aunt and uncle let you come? I really hope you can. If not, I'll see you on the Hogwarts Express on September 1st. Love, from Hermione. P.S. Ron says Percy's head boy. I'll bet Percy's really pleased. Ron doesn't seem too happy about it. Harry laughed as he put Hermione's letter aside and picked up her present. It was very heavy. Knowing Hermione, he was sure it would be a large book full of very difficult spells. But it wasn't. His heart gave a huge bound as he ripped back the paper and saw a sleek black leather case with silver words stamped across it reading, "Broomstick Servicing Kit." "Wow, Hermione," Harry whispered, unzipping the case to look inside. There was a large jar of Fleetwood's high-finish handle polish, a pair of gleaming silver tail-twig clippers, a tiny brass compass to clip on your broom for long journeys, and a handbook of do-it-yourself broom care. Apart from his friends, the thing that Harry missed most about Hogwarts was Quidditch, the most popular sport in the magical world. Highly dangerous, very exciting, and played on broomsticks. Harry happened to be a very good Quidditch player. He had been the youngest person in a century to be picked for one of the Hogwarts house teams. One of Harry's most prized possessions was his Nimbus 2000 racing broom. Harry put the leather case aside and picked up his last parcel. He recognized the untidy scrawl on the brown paper at once. This was from Hagrid, the Hogwarts gamekeeper. He tore off the top layer of paper and glimpsed something green and leathery, but before he could unwrap it properly, the parcel gave a strange quiver, and whatever was inside it snapped loudly, as though it had jaws. Harry froze. He knew that Hagrid would never send him anything dangerous on purpose, but then Hagrid didn't have a normal person's view of what was dangerous. Hagrid had been known to befriend giant spiders, buy vicious three-headed dogs from men in pubs, and sneak illegal dragon eggs into his cabin. Harry poked the parcel nervously. It snapped loudly again. Harry reached for the lamp on his bedside table, gripped it firmly in one hand, and raised it over his head, ready to strike. Then he seized the rest of the wrapping paper in the other hand and pulled. And out fell a book. Harry just had time to register its handsome green cover, emblazoned with the golden title, The Monster Book of Monsters, before it flipped onto its edge and scuttled sideways along the bed like some weird crab. "Uh-oh," Harry muttered. The book toppled off the bed with a loud clunk and shuffled rapidly across the room. Harry followed it stealthily. The book was hiding in the dark space under his desk. Praying that the Dursleys were still fast asleep, Harry got down on his hands and knees and reached towards it. Ouch! The book snapped shut on his hand and then flapped past him, still scuttling on its covers. Harry scrambled around, threw himself forward, and managed to flatten it. Uncle Vernon gave a loud, sleepy grunt in the room next door. Hedwig and Errol watched interestedly as Harry clamped the struggling book tightly in his arms, hurried to his chest of drawers, and pulled out a belt, which he buckled tightly around it. The monster book shuddered angrily, but could no longer flap and snap, so Harry threw it down on the bed and reached for Hagrid's card. "Dear Harry, happy birthday. Think you might find this useful for next year. Won't say no more here. Tell you when I see you. Hope the Muggles are treating you right. All the best, Hagrid." It struck Harry as ominous that Hagrid thought a biting book would come in useful, but he put Hagrid's card up next to Ron's and Hermione's, grinning more broadly than ever. Now there was only the letter from Hogwarts left. Noticing that it was rather thicker than usual, Harry slit open the envelope, pulled out the first page of parchment within, and read, "Dear Mr. Potter, please note that the new school year will begin on September the 1st. The Hogwarts Express will leave from King's Cross Station, platform 9 3/4, at 11 o'clock. Third years are permitted to visit the village of Hogsmeade on certain weekends. Please give the enclosed permission form to your parent or guardian to sign. A list of books for next year is enclosed. Yours sincerely, Professor M. McGonagall, Deputy Headmistress." Harry pulled out the Hogsmeade permission form and looked at it, no longer grinning. It would be wonderful to visit Hogsmeade on weekends. He knew it was an entirely wizarding village, and he had never set foot there. But how on earth was he going to persuade Uncle Vernon or Aunt Petunia to sign the form? He looked over at the alarm clock. It was now 2 o'clock in the morning. Deciding he'd worry about the Hogsmeade form when he woke up, Harry got back into bed and reached up to cross off another day on the chart he'd made for himself, counting down the days left until his return to Hogwarts. Then he took off his glasses and lay down, eyes open, facing his three birthday cards. Extremely unusual, though he was, at that moment, Harry Potter felt just like everyone else, glad for the first time in his life that it was his birthday. Chapter 2. Aunt Marge's Big Mistake. Harry went down to breakfast the next morning to find the three Dursleys already sitting around the kitchen table. They were watching a brand new television, a welcome home for the summer present for Dudley, who had been complaining loudly about the long walk between the fridge and the television in the living room. Dudley had spent most of the summer in the kitchen, his piggy little eyes fixed on the screen and his five chins wobbling as he ate continually. Harry sat down between Dudley and Uncle Vernon, a large, beefy man with very little neck and a lot of moustache. Far from wishing Harry a happy birthday, none of the Dursleys made any sign that they had noticed Harry enter the room, but Harry was far too used to this to care. He helped himself to a piece of toast and then looked up at the reporter on the television, who was halfway through a report on an escaped convict. "The public is warned that Black is armed and extremely dangerous. A special hotline has been set up, and any sighting of Black should be reported immediately."
"No need to tell us he's no good," snorted Uncle Vernon, staring over the top of his newspaper at the prisoner. "Look at the state of him, the filthy layabout. Look at his hair."
He shot a nasty look sideways at Harry, whose untidy hair had always been a source of great annoyance to Uncle Vernon. Compared to the man on the television, however, whose gaunt face was surrounded by a matted, elbow-length tangle, Harry felt very well-groomed indeed. The reporter had reappeared.
"The Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries will announce today..."
"Hang on," barked Uncle Vernon, staring furiously at the reporter. "You didn't tell us where that maniac's escaped from. What use is that? Lunatic could be coming up the street right now."
Aunt Petunia, who was bony and horse-faced, whipped around and peered intently out of the kitchen window. Harry knew Aunt Petunia would simply love to be the one to call the hotline number. She was the nosiest woman in the world and spent most of her life spying on the boring, law-abiding neighbours.
"When will they learn,"
said Uncle Vernon, pounding the table with his large purple fist,
"that hanging's the only way to deal with these people?"
"Very true,"
said Aunt Petunia, who was still squinting into next door's runner beans. Uncle Vernon drained his teacup, glanced at his watch, and added,
"I'd better be off in a minute, Petunia. Marge's train gets in at 10.
Harry, whose thoughts had been upstairs with the broomstick servicing kit, was brought back to earth with an unpleasant bump.
"Aunt March?" he blurted out. "She's not coming here, is she?"
Aunt Marge was Uncle Vernon's sister. Even though she was not a blood relative of Harry's, whose mother had been Aunt Petunia's sister, he had been forced to call her Aunt all his life. Aunt Marge lived in the country, in a house with a large garden where she bred bulldogs. She didn't often stay at Privet Drive because she couldn't bear to leave her precious dogs, but each of her visits stood out horribly vividly in Harry's mind. At Dudley's fifth birthday party, Aunt Marge had whacked Harry around the shins with her walking stick to stop him from beating Dudley at musical statues. A few years later, she had turned up at Christmas with a computerized robot for Dudley and a box of dog biscuits for Harry. On her last visit, the year before Harry started at Hogwarts, Harry had accidentally trodden on the tail of her favorite dog. Ripper had chased Harry out into the garden and up a tree, and Aunt Marge had refused to call him off until past midnight. The memory of this incident still brought tears of laughter to Dudley's eyes.
"Marge will be here for a week," Uncle Vernon snarled, "and while we're on the subject," he pointed a fat finger threateningly at Harry, "we need to get a few things straight before I go and collect her."
Dudley smirked and withdrew his gaze from the television. Watching Harry being bullied by Uncle Vernon was Dudley's favorite form of entertainment.
"Firstly," growled Uncle Vernon, "you'll keep a civil tongue in your head when you're talking to Marge."
"All right," said Harry bitterly, "if she does, when she's talking to me."
"Secondly," said Uncle Vernon, acting as though he'd not heard Harry's reply, "as Marge doesn't know anything about your abnormality, I don't want any funny stuff while she's here. You behave yourself. Got me?"
"I will, if she does," said Harry through gritted teeth.
"And thirdly," said Uncle Vernon, his mean little eyes now slits in his great purple face, "we've told Marge you attend St. Brutus's Secure Center for Incurably Criminal Boys."
"What?" Harry yelled.
"And you'll be sticking to that story, boy, or there'll be trouble," spat Uncle Vernon.
Harry sat there, white-faced and furious, staring at Uncle Vernon, hardly able to believe it. Aunt Marge coming for a week-long visit? It was the worst birthday present the Dursleys had ever given him, including that pair of Uncle Vernon's old socks.
"Well, Petunia," said Uncle Vernon, getting heavily to his feet, "I'll be off to the station then. Want to come along for the ride, Dudders?"
"No,"
said Dudley, whose attention had returned to the television now that Uncle Vernon had finished threatening Harry.
"Daddy's got to make himself smart for his auntie,"
said Aunt Petunia, smoothing Dudley's thick blonde hair.
"Mummy's bought him a lovely new bow tie."
Uncle Vernon clapped Dudley on his porky shoulder.
"See you in a bit, then,"
he said, and he left the kitchen. Harry, who had been sitting in a kind of horrified trance, had a sudden idea. Abandoning his toast, he got quickly to his feet and followed Uncle Vernon to the front door. Uncle Vernon was pulling on his car coat.
"I'm not taking you," he snarled as he turned to see Harry watching him.
"Like I wanted to come," said Harry coldly. "I want to ask you something." Uncle Vernon eyed him suspiciously.
"Third years at my school are allowed to visit the village sometimes," said Harry.
"So?" snapped Uncle Vernon, taking his car keys from a hook next to the door.
"I need you to sign the permission form," said Harry in a rush. "And why should I do that?" sneered Uncle Vernon.
"Well," said Harry, choosing his words carefully, "it'll be hard work pretending to Aunt Marge I go to St. What's-its."
"St. Brutus's Secure Center for Incurably Criminal Boys," bellowed Uncle Vernon,
and Harry was pleased to hear a definite note of panic in Uncle Vernon's voice.
"Exactly," said Harry, looking calmly up into Uncle Vernon's large purple face. "It's a lot to remember. I'll have to make it sound convincing, won't I? What if I accidentally let something slip?"
"You'll get the stuffing knocked out of you, won't you?"
roared Uncle Vernon, advancing on Harry with his fist raised. But Harry stood his ground.
"Knocking the stuffing out of me won't make Aunt Marge forget what I could tell her," he said grimly.
Uncle Vernon stopped, his fist still raised, his face an ugly puce. "But if you sign my permission form," Harry went on quickly, "I swear I'll remember where I'm supposed to go to school, and I'll act like a mug, like I'm normal and everything." Harry could tell that Uncle Vernon was thinking it over, even if his teeth were bared and a vein was throbbing in his temple. "Right," he snapped finally. "I shall monitor your behaviour carefully during Margie's visit. If, at the end of it, you've toed the line and kept to the story, I'll sign your ruddy form." He wheeled around, pulled open the front door, and slammed it so hard that one of the little panes of glass at the top fell out. Harry didn't return to the kitchen. He went back upstairs to his bedroom. If he was going to act like a real muggle, he'd better start now. Slowly and sadly, he gathered up all his presents and his birthday cards and hid them under the loose floorboard with his homework. Then he went to Hedwig's cage. Errol seemed to have recovered. He and Hedwig were both asleep, heads under their wings. Harry sighed, then poked them both awake. "Hedwig," he said gloomily, "you're going to have to clear off for a week. Go with Errol. Ron'll look after you. I'll write him a note explaining. And don't look at me like that." Hedwig's large amber eyes were reproachful. "It's not my fault. It's the only way I'll be allowed to visit Hogsmeade with Ron and Hermione." 10 minutes later, Errol and Hedwig, who had a note to Ron bound to her leg, soared out of the window and out of sight. Harry, now feeling thoroughly miserable, put the empty cage away inside the wardrobe. But Harry didn't have long to brood. In next to no time, Aunt Petunia was shrieking up the stairs for Harry to come down and get ready to welcome their guests.
"Do something about your hair,"
Aunt Petunia snapped as he reached the hall. Harry couldn't see the point of trying to make his hair lie flat. Aunt Marge loved criticizing him, so the untidier he looked, the happier she would be. All too soon there was a crunch of gravel outside as Uncle Vernon's car pulled back into the driveway, then the clunk of the car doors and footsteps on the garden path.
"Get the door!"
Aunt Petunia hissed at Harry. A feeling of great gloom in his stomach, Harry pulled the door open. On the threshold stood Aunt Marge. She was very like Uncle Vernon, large, beefy, and purple-faced. She even had a moustache, though not as bushy as his. In one hand she held an enormous suitcase, and tucked under the other was an old and evil-tempered bulldog.
"Where's my Dudders?"
roared Aunt Marge.
"Where's my Nephi-poo?"
Dudley came waddling down the hall, his blonde hair plastered flat to his fat head, a bow tie just visible under his many chins. Aunt Marge thrust the suitcase into Harry's stomach, knocking the wind out of him, seized Dudley in a tight, one-armed hug, and planted a large kiss on his cheek. Harry knew perfectly well that Dudley only put up with Aunt Marge's hugs because he was well paid for it, and sure enough, when they broke apart, Dudley had a crisp 20-pound note clutched in his fat fist.
"Petunia!"
shouted Aunt Marge, striding past Harry as though he was a hat-stand. Aunt Marge and Aunt Petunia kissed, or rather, Aunt Marge bumped her large jaw against Aunt Petunia's bony cheekbone. Uncle Vernon now came in, smiling jovially as he shut the door.
"Tea, Marge?" he said. "And what will Ripper take?"
"Ripper can have some tea out of my saucer," said Aunt Marge as they all proceeded into the kitchen,
leaving Harry alone in the hall with the suitcase. But Harry wasn't complaining. Any excuse not to be with Aunt Marge was fine by him, so he began to heave the case upstairs into the spare bedroom, taking as long as he could. By the time he got back to the kitchen, Aunt Marge had been supplied with tea and fruitcake, and Ripper was lapping noisily in the corner. Harry saw Aunt Petunia wince slightly as specks of tea and drool flecked her clean floor. Aunt Petunia hated animals.
"Who's looking after the other dogs, Marge?" Uncle Vernon asked.
"Oh, I've got Colonel Thubster managing them," boomed Aunt Marge. "He's retired now. Good for him to have something to do. But I couldn't leave poor old Ripper. He pines if he's away from me."
Ripper began to growl again as Harry sat down. This directed Aunt Marge's attention to Harry for the first time.
"So," she barked, "still here, are you?"
"Yes,"
said Harry.
"Don't you say yes in that ungrateful tone,"
Aunt Marge growled.
"It's damn good of Vernon and Petunia to keep you. Wouldn't have done it myself. You'd have gone straight to an orphanage if you'd been dumped on my doorstep."
Harry was bursting to say that he'd rather live in an orphanage than with the Dursleys, but the thought of the Hogsmeade form stopped him. He forced his face into a painful smile.
"Don't you smirk at me," boomed Aunt Marge. "I can see you haven't improved since I last saw you. I hope school would knock some manners into you."
She took a large gulp of tea, wiped her moustache and said,
"Where is it that you send him again, Vernon?"
"St. Brutus's," said Uncle Vernon promptly. "It's a first-rate institution for hopeless cases."
"I see," said Aunt Marge. "Do they use the cane, St. Brutus's boy?"
She barked across the table. Uncle Vernon nodded curtly behind Aunt Marge's back. "Yes," said Harry. Then, feeling he might as well do the thing properly, he added, "all the time."
"Excellent," said Aunt Marge. "I won't have this namby-pamby wishy-washy nonsense about not hitting people who deserve it. A good thrashing is what's needed in 99 cases out of 100. Have you been beaten often?"
"Oh, yeah," said Harry. "Loads of times." Aunt Marge narrowed her eyes.
"I still don't like your tone, boy," she said. "If you can speak of your beatings in that casual way, they clearly aren't hitting you hard enough. Petunia, I'd write if I were you. Make it clear that you approve the use of extreme force in this boy's case."
Perhaps Uncle Vernon was worried that Harry might forget their bargain. In any case, he changed the subject abruptly.
"Heard the news this morning, Marge? What about that escaped prisoner, eh?"
As Aunt Marge started to make herself at home, Harry caught himself thinking almost longingly of life at Number 4 without her. Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia usually encouraged Harry to stay out of their way, which Harry was only too happy to do. Aunt Marge, on the other hand, wanted Harry under her eyes at all times, so that she could boom out suggestions for his improvement. She delighted in comparing Harry with Dudley, and took huge pleasure in buying Dudley expensive presents while glaring at Harry, as though daring him to ask why he hadn't got a present too. She also kept throwing out dark hints about what made Harry such an unsatisfactory person.
"You mustn't blame yourself for the way the boys turned out, Vernon," she said over lunch on the third day. "If there's something rotten on the inside, there's nothing anyone can do about it."
Harry tried to concentrate on his food, but his hands shook and his face was starting to burn with anger. "Remember the form," he told himself. "Think about Hogsmeade. Don't say anything. Don't rise." Aunt Marge reached for her glass of wine.
"It's one of the basic rules of breeding," she said. "You see it all the time with dogs. If there's something wrong with the bitch, there'll be something wrong with the pup."
At that moment, the wine glass Aunt Marge was holding exploded in her hand. Shards of glass flew in every direction, and Aunt Marge sputtered and blinked, her great ruddy face dripping.
"Marge!" squealed Aunt Petunia. "Marge, are you all right?"
"Not to worry," grunted Aunt Marge, mopping her face with her napkin. "Must have squeezed it too hard. Did the same thing at Colonel Fubster's the other day. No need to fuss, Petunia. I have a very firm grip."
But Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon were both looking at Harry suspiciously, so he decided he'd better skip dessert and escape from the table as soon as he could. Outside in the hall, he leaned against the wall, breathing deeply. It had been a long time since he'd lost control and made something explode. He couldn't afford to let it happen again. The Hogsmeade form wasn't the only thing at stake. If he carried on like that, he'd be in trouble with the Ministry of Magic. Harry was still an underage wizard, and he was forbidden by wizard law to do magic outside school. His record wasn't exactly clean, either. Only last summer he'd gotten an official warning that had stated quite clearly that if the Ministry got wind of any more magic in Privet Drive, Harry would face expulsion from Hogwarts. He heard the Dursleys leaving the table and hurried upstairs out of the way.
Harry got through the next 3 days by forcing himself to think about his handbook of do-it-yourself broom care whenever Aunt Marge started on him. This worked quite well, though it seemed to give him a glazed look, because Aunt Marge started voicing the opinion that he was mentally subnormal. At last, at long last, the final evening of Marge's stay arrived. Aunt Petunia cooked a fancy dinner, and Uncle Vernon uncorked several bottles of wine. They got all the way through the soup and the salmon without a single mention of Harry's faults. During the lemon meringue pie, Uncle Vernon bored them all with a long talk about Grunnings, his drill-making company. Then Aunt Petunia made coffee, and Uncle Vernon brought out a bottle of brandy.
"Can I tempt you, Marge?"
Aunt Marge had already had quite a lot of wine. Her huge face was very red.
"Just a small one, then," she chuckled. "A bit more than that, and a bit more. That's the ticket."
Dudley was eating his fourth slice of pie. Aunt Petunia was sipping coffee with her little finger sticking out. Harry really wanted to disappear into his bedroom, but he met Uncle Vernon's angry little eyes and knew he would have to sit it out.
"Oh," said Aunt Marge, smacking her lips and putting the empty brandy glass back down. "Excellent nosh, Petunia. It's normally just a fry-up for me of an evening, with 12 dogs to look after."
She burped richly and patted her great tweed stomach.
"Pardon me, but I do like to see a healthy-sized boy," she went on, winking at Dudley. "You'll be a proper-sized man, Dudders, like your father. Yes, I'll have a spot more brandy, Vernon. Now this one here..."
She jerked her head at Harry, who felt his stomach clench. "The handbook," he thought quickly.
"This one's got a mean, runty look about him. You get that with dogs. I had Colonel Fubster drown one last year. Ratty little thing it was. Weak. Underbred."
Harry was trying to remember page 12 of his book, A Charm to Cure Reluctant Reversers.
"It all comes down to blood, as I was saying the other day. Bad blood will out. Now, I'm saying nothing against your family, Petunia."
She patted Aunt Petunia's bony hand with her shovel-like one.
"But your sister was a bad egg. They turn up in the best families. Then she ran off with a wastrel, and here's the result right in front of us."
Harry was staring at his plate, a funny ringing in his ears. "Grasp your broom firmly by the tail," he thought. But he couldn't remember what came next. Aunt Marge's voice seemed to be boring into him like one of Uncle Vernon's drills.
"This potter,"
said Aunt Marge loudly, seizing the brandy bottle and splashing more into her glass and over the tablecloth.
"You never told me what he did."
Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia were looking extremely tense. Dudley had even looked up from his pie to gape at his parents.
"He didn't work," said Uncle Vernon, with half a glance at Harry.
"Unemployed." "As I expected," said Aunt Marge, taking a huge swig of brandy and wiping her chin on her sleeve. "A no-count, good-for-nothing, lazy scrounger who he was not," said Harry suddenly.
The table went very quiet. Harry was shaking all over. He had never felt so angry in his life.
"More brandy!"
yelled Uncle Vernon, who had gone very white. He emptied the bottle into Aunt Marge's glass.
"You, boy," he snarled at Harry. "Go to bed. Go on."
"No, Vernon,"
hiccuped Aunt Marge, holding up a hand, her tiny bloodshot eyes fixed on Harry's.
"Go on, boy. Go on. Proud of your parents, are you? They go and get themselves killed in a car crash. Drunk, I expect."
"They didn't die in a car crash," said Harry, who found himself on his feet.
"They died in a car crash, you nasty little liar, and left you to be a burden on their decent, hard-working relatives,"
screamed Aunt Marge, swelling with fury.
"You are an insolent, ungrateful little..."
But Aunt Marge suddenly stopped speaking. For a moment it looked as though words had failed her. She seemed to be swelling with inexpressible anger. But the swelling didn't stop. Her great red face started to expand. Her tiny eyes bulged, and her mouth stretched too tightly for speech. Next second, several buttons had just burst from her tweed jacket and pinged off the walls. She was inflating like a monstrous balloon, her stomach bursting free of her tweed waistband, each of her fingers blowing up like a salami. "Marge!" yelled Uncle Vernon and Aunt Petunia together as Aunt Marge's whole body began to rise off her chair toward the ceiling. She was entirely round now, like a vast life buoy with piggy eyes, and her hands and feet stuck out weirdly as she drifted up into the air, making apoplectic popping noises. Ripper came skidding into the room, barking madly. "No!" Uncle Vernon seized one of Marge's feet and tried to pull her down again, but was almost lifted from the floor himself. A second later, Ripper leaped forward and sank his teeth into Uncle Vernon's leg. Harry tore from the dining room before anyone could stop him, heading for the cupboard under the stairs. The cupboard door burst magically open as he reached it. In seconds, he had heaved his trunk to the front door. He sprinted upstairs and threw himself under the bed, wrenching up the loose floorboard, and grabbed the pillowcase full of his books and birthday presents. He wriggled out, seized Hedwig's empty cage, and dashed back downstairs to his trunk, just as Uncle Vernon burst out of the dining room, his trouser leg in bloody tatters.
"Come back in here," he bellowed. "Come back and put her right."
But a reckless rage had come over Harry. He kicked his trunk open, pulled out his wand, and pointed it at Uncle Vernon.
"She deserved it," Harry said, breathing very fast. "She deserved what she got. You keep away from me."
He fumbled behind him for the latch on the door.
"I'm going," Harry said. "I've had enough."
And in the next moment he was out in the dark, quiet street, heaving his heavy trunk behind him, Hedwig's cage under his arm. Chapter 3. The Night Bus. Harry was several streets away before he collapsed onto a low wall in Magnolia Crescent, panting from the effort of dragging his trunk. He sat quite still, anger still surging through him, listening to the frantic thumping of his heart. But after 10 minutes alone in the dark street, a new emotion overtook him. Panic. Whichever way he looked at it, he had never been in a worse fix. He was stranded quite alone in the dark muggle world with absolutely nowhere to go. And the worst of it was he had just done serious magic, which meant that he was almost certainly expelled from Hogwarts. He had broken the decree for the restriction of underage wizardry so badly he was surprised Ministry of Magic representatives weren't swooping down on him where he sat. Harry shivered and looked up and down Magnolia Crescent. What was going to happen to him? Would he be arrested, or would he simply be outlawed from the wizarding world? He thought of Ron and Hermione, and his heart sank even lower. Harry was sure that, criminal or not, Ron and Hermione would want to help him now, but they were both abroad, and with Hedwig gone, he had no means of contacting them. He didn't have any muggle money either. There was a little wizard gold in the money bag at the bottom of his trunk, but the rest of the fortune his parents had left him was stored in a vault at Gringotts Wizarding Bank in London. He'd never be able to drag his trunk all the way to London unless... He looked down at his wand, which he was still clutching in his hand. If he was already expelled, his heart was now thumping painfully fast. A bit more magic couldn't hurt. He had the invisibility cloak he had inherited from his father. What if he bewitched the trunk to make it feather light, tied it to his broomstick, covered himself in the cloak, and flew to London? Then he could get the rest of his money out of his vault and begin his life as an outcast. It was a horrible prospect, but he couldn't sit on this wall forever, or he'd find himself trying to explain to Muggle police why he was out in the dead of night with a trunk full of spell books and a broomstick. Harry opened his trunk again and pushed the contents aside, looking for the invisibility cloak. But before he had found it, he straightened up suddenly, looking around him once more. A funny prickling on the back of his neck had made Harry feel he was being watched, but the street appeared to be deserted, and no lights shone from any of the large square houses. He bent over his trunk again, but almost immediately stood up once more, his hand clenched on his wand. He had sensed rather than heard it. Someone or something was standing in the narrow gap between the garage and the fence behind him. Harry squinted at the black alleyway. If only it would move, then he'd know whether it was just a stray cat or something else.
Lumos,
Harry muttered, and a light appeared at the end of his wand, almost dazzling him. He held it high over his head, and the pebble-dashed walls of number two suddenly sparkled. The garage door gleamed, and between them Harry saw, quite distinctly, the hulking outline of something very big, with wide, gleaming eyes. Harry stepped backward. His legs hit his trunk, and he tripped. His wand flew out of his hand as he flung out an arm to break his fall, and he landed hard in the gutter. There was a deafening bang, and Harry threw up his hands to shield his eyes against a sudden blinding light. With a yell, he rolled back onto the pavement just in time. A second later, a gigantic pair of wheels and headlights screeched to a halt exactly where Harry had just been lying. They belonged, as Harry saw when he raised his head, to a triple-decker, violently purple bus, which had appeared out of thin air. Gold lettering over the windshield spelled, "The Night Bus." For a split second, Harry wondered if he had been knocked silly by his fall. Then a conductor in a purple uniform leapt out of the bus and began to speak loudly to the night.
"Welcome to the Night Bus. Emergency transport for the stranded witch or wizard. Just stick out your wand hand, step on board, and we can take you anywhere you want to go. My name is Stan Shunpike, and I will be your conductor this evening."
The conductor stopped abruptly. He had just caught sight of Harry, who was still sitting on the ground. Harry snatched up his wand again and scrambled to his feet. Close up, he saw that Stan Shunpike was only a few years older than he was, 18 or 19 at most, with large, protruding ears and quite a few pimples.
"What were you doing down there?"
said Stan, dropping his professional manner.
"Fell over," said Harry.
"What'd you fall over for?"
sniggered Stan.
"I didn't do it on purpose," said Harry, annoyed. One of the knees in his jeans was torn, and the hand he had thrown out to break his fall was bleeding.
He suddenly remembered why he had fallen over and turned around quickly to stare at the alleyway between the garage and the fence. The night bus's headlamps were flooding it with light, and it was empty.
"What you looking at?"
said Stan.
"There was a big black thing," said Harry, pointing uncertainly into the gap, "like a dog, but massive."
He looked around at Stan, whose mouth was slightly open. With a feeling of unease, Harry saw Stan's eyes move to the scar on Harry's forehead.
"What's that on your head?" said Stan abruptly.
"Nothing," said Harry quickly, flattening his hair over his scar. If the Ministry of Magic was looking for him, he didn't want to make it too easy for them.
"What's your name?" Stan persisted.
"Neville Longbottom," said Harry, saying the first name that came into his head.
So this bus," he went on quickly, hoping to distract Stan, "did you say it goes anywhere?"
"Yep,"
said Stan proudly.
"Anywhere you like, long as it's on land. Can't do nothing underwater."
"Here,"
he said, looking suspicious again.
"You did flag us down, didn't you? Stuck out your wand and, didn't you?"
"Yes," said Harry quickly.
"Listen, how much would it be to get to London?"
11 sickles, said Stan. "But for 13, you get hot chocolate. And for 15, you get an hot water bottle and a toothbrush in the colour of your choice."
Harry rummaged once more in his trunk, extracted his money bag, and shoved some gold into Stan's hand. He and Stan then lifted his trunk with Hedwig's cage balanced on top up the steps of the bus. There were no seats. Instead, half a dozen brass bedsteads stood beside the curtained windows. Candles were burning in brackets beside each bed, illuminating the wood-panelled walls. A tiny wizard in a nightcap at the rear of the bus muttered,
"Not now, thanks. I'm pickling some slugs,"
and rolled over in his sleep.
"You have this one,"
Stan whispered, shoving Harry's trunk under the bed, right behind the driver, who was sitting in an armchair in front of the steering wheel.
"This is our driver, Ernie Prang. This is Neville Longbottom, Ern."
Ernie Prang, an elderly wizard wearing very thick glasses, nodded to Harry, who nervously flattened his bangs again and sat down on his bed.
"Take her away, Ern," said Stan, sitting down in the armchair next to Ernie's.
There was another tremendous bang, and the next moment Harry found himself flat on his bed, thrown backward by the speed of the night bus. Pulling himself up, Harry stared out of the dark window and saw that they were now bowling along a completely different street. Stan was watching Harry's stunned face with great enjoyment.
"This is where we was before you flagged us down," he said. "Where are we, Ern? Somewhere in Wales?"
"Ah," said Ernie. "How come the muggles don't hear the bus?" said Harry.
"Them," said Stan contemptuously, "don't listen properly, do they? Don't look properly, either. Never notice nothing, they don't."
"Best go wake up Madam Marsh, Stan," said Ern. "We'll be in Abergavenny in a minute."
Stan passed Harry's bed and disappeared up a narrow wooden staircase. Harry was still looking out of the window, feeling increasingly nervous. Ernie didn't seem to have mastered the use of a steering wheel. The night bus kept mounting the pavement, but it didn't hit anything. Lines of lampposts, mailboxes, and trash cans jumped out of its way as it approached, and back into position once it had passed. Stan came back downstairs, followed by a faintly green witch wrapped in a travelling cloak.
"Here you go, Madam Marsh," said Stan happily as Ern stamped on the brake, and the bed slid a foot or so toward the front of the bus.
Madam Marsh clamped a handkerchief to her mouth and tottered down the steps. Stan threw her bag out after her and rammed the doors shut. There was another loud bang, and they were thundering down a narrow country lane, trees leaping out of the way. Harry wouldn't have been able to sleep even if he had been travelling on a bus that didn't keep banging loudly and jumping 100 miles at a time. His stomach churned as he fell back to wondering what was going to happen to him, and whether the Dursleys had managed to get Aunt Marge off the ceiling yet. Stan had unfurled a copy of the Daily Prophet and was now reading with his tongue between his teeth. A large photograph of a sunken-faced man with long matted hair blinked slowly at Harry from the front page. He looked strangely familiar.
"That man," Harry said, forgetting his troubles for a moment, "he was on the Muggle News."
Stanley turned to the front page and chuckled.
"Sirius Black," he said, nodding. "Course he was on the Muggle News, Neville. Where have you been?"
He gave a superior sort of chuckle at the blank look on Harry's face, removed the front page and handed it to Harry.
"You ought to read the papers more, Neville."
Harry held the paper up to the candlelight and read, "Black still at large. Sirius Black, possibly the most infamous prisoner ever to be held in Azkaban Fortress, is still eluding capture, the Ministry of Magic confirmed today. We are doing all we can to recapture Black," said the Minister of Magic, Cornelius Fudge, this morning, "and we beg the magical community to remain calm. Fudge has been criticized by some members of the International Federation of Warlocks for informing the Muggle Prime Minister of the crisis. Well, really, I had to, don't you know," said an irritable Fudge. "Black is mad. He's a danger to anyone who crosses him, magic or muggle. I have the Prime Minister's assurance that he will not breathe a word of Black's true identity to anyone. And let's face it, who'd believe him if he did?" While muggles have been told that Black is carrying a gun, a kind of metal wand that muggles use to kill each other, the magical community lives in fear of a massacre like that of 12 years ago, when Black murdered 13 people with a single curse. Harry looked into the shadowed eyes of Sirius Black, the only part of the sunken face that seemed alive. Harry had never met a vampire, but he had seen pictures of them in his Defense Against the Dark Arts classes, and Black, with his waxy white skin, looked just like one.
"Scary-looking thing, isn't he?"
said Stan, who had been watching Harry read.
"He murdered 13 people,"
said Harry, handing the page back to Stan, "with one curse?"
"Yep," said Stan, "in front of witnesses and all. Broad daylight. Big trouble it caused, didn't it, Ern?"
"Arr," said Ern darkly.
Stan swiveled in his armchair, his hands on the back, the better to look at Harry.
Black was a big supporter of you know who, he said.
What, Voldemort? Said Harry, without thinking. Even Stan's pimples went white. Ern jerked the steering wheel so hard that a whole farmhouse had to jump aside to avoid the bus.
You out of your tree, yelped Stan. What'd you say his name for?
Sorry, said Harry hastily. Sorry, I forgot.
Forgot? Said Stan weakly. Blimey, my heart's going that fast.
So Black was a supporter of you-know-who?